Mr. King, Reel 16. How were the men performing in those early hours?
Oh, very well, very well. I was really impressed, indeed. Everybody seemed to, settle in, you know. There's no sort of panic stations or anything like that, and it did really well.
Did you feel that, although these were very early days, but did you feel that the training that you'd been having in Scotland and England was appropriate to the kind of actions you were having?
I think the training had gone well, actually. In fact, it showed itself on that day in particular, I think, that everybody, you know, as I say, there was no sort of panic station. Everybody just did what they were told, and, you know, there was no sort of... I think everybody did very well, you know. They were taking cover better, you know what I mean? Everybody was sort of using the cover that they could. Well, naturally, of course, it was there. But certainly, yeah, I think the training was paying off. They were being really sensible about what they were doing, in fact, you know.
Were you taking any prisoners?
Very few then. In fact, the first German I saw was when we were marching up the road after we'd been in the cemetery, after we'd formed up. The first one I saw was dead, as it happened, lying behind a hedge. Well, I don't know where he'd been caught or whether he'd just been an orderly or whatever. It was just a single bloke, like on his own, just one bloke, and he seemed a fairly old fella. You know, he didn't seem a young man, like a young. And he was just lying in this hedge. So I don't know how he got killed, like, but that was the first one I saw in France, in fact. Yeah.
What were you doing with your company at that point?
Well, I was in Company HQ, of course, with Sir Captain Barrett. We had Company HQ, of course. We were mostly just, as it happened, on a follow up exercise, really. We had the wireless operators, you know, with us and that sort of thing, and getting the company runners, and, you know, just sort of making sure the company runners were out and coming back, and relaying the. Of course, we have no need of sort of ammo refills then. Of course, I was weighed down like it was better when I went ashore. I had binoculars, map case, really ammo strewn around, you know, like Schwarzenegger. And I think, well, everybody, of course, had extra ammo. You know, they all had bandoliers. Everybody had extra bandoliers, of course. So there was no need to sort of worry about ammo at that stage of the game.
Were you coming across any particular obstacles that the enemy had formed for you?
No, there didn't seem to be a lot of wire or anything like that that we bumped. We bumped this, as I say, we seemed to bump this little mine. There's some mines, but they were always marked. They were marked, actually, you know, Acton Mine. And, so they, you know, as I say, inadvertently, I think, they jumped into this minefield over the back of the cemetery wall. But no, there didn't seem to be a great deal of anti-tank stuff kicking about, you know. I noticed there was a lot of anti-glider stuff. You know, there seemed to be a lot of wiring in that later on. That was maybe about that night, the same night, of course, when the gliders came down on us, when we were sort of holding the ground for the gliders to come in. I don't think it had been anticipated we were going to hold the ground, but I think the Gladys came down there among us. We didn't sort of realise that that's where they were going to be. But I have the recollection of all these bloody gliders coming down. They seem to be coming down from all angles, in among the trees, you know, ploughing the trees up in the orchards and all over the bloody place. That did seem to be a bit of a cock-up, like it hadn't been, but to us, like, it seemed as if they were coming in all over the bloody place, these gliders, the horse gliders. So, you know, it was all a bit chaotic, of course, as you appreciate, but before we sort of finally got all ourselves sorted out, and as a battalion, you know what I mean, as a battalion where we knew who was following who and who was back up and who was, you know, it all seemed a bit strange at that time.
Were you held in one position for a while whilst this was happening? Sorting out.
Well, the first form up area, of course, was the cemetery, and then as I say, we went on towards this place called Colleyville, I think it was, and then we finally ended up sort of forming up as a battalion, you know, like really formed up. Around these places called Bayville and Bowville, and that seemed to be sort of the mainstay of the. I don't know whether that was on day the after, maybe afterwards. Bayville and Bowville, we seemed to be. We attacked this wood, I remember, this Levesey wood. On the main line of attack, we suddenly found ourselves on this main Carn road, the main road to Carn, I think. Anyway, the first initial assault that we were told we were going to make was we were going to follow B Company and A Company. We were going to assault this wood, and we were going to follow through on the way to Carn. With the opposition was that heavy, a lot of small arms stuff and snipers that we got held up there, and then we finally reformed at Bayville and Bourville, I think. And I remember we seemed to be there quite a while after Day. We seemed to be there quite a while, way a month in fact. I think we were there.
Do you recall on D-Day itself having to link up with the paras who'd come around the canal?
Yeah, we linked up with the paratroops on the left side of the canal. And that's where we held the glide. That's where all the gliders were coming in, of course.
Do you recall linking up with them and meeting them?
Yeah, I remember meeting the lads. Now, who was... I can remember meeting the paratroopers on this just on this left of this bridge, in fact. And then, of course, all the gliders started coming in. The airborne troops started coming in.
They must have been pleased to see you.
Well, we sort of held the area, really. I think we were, although it maybe wasn't planned that we were going to hold the area, we'd been held up, I think. You know. Further on, I think the troops had been held up further on, and we were held up. And as it happens, we were in this area when the gliders came down. So maybe just coincidence that we were there and helped, you know, hold that area while they got themselves sorted out. You know, they went up towards the bridge, of course. You know, on our left, they were. They were sort of left. We were left of the. I think we were the left brigade of the division, and then they were sort of further on when they took them the when they liberated the cafe and all that sort of thing, you know.
Had you had any clashes with the Germans at that time? Around that time?
Yeah, well, it's mostly snipers. And I think Bay Company had a run-in with some of them on the top on this hill towards Labasi village. And I think they captured one or two Germans there. But it was all really fluid. I remember walking up these cornfields, and the corn seemed about chest height. And he was Captain Ealing. I remember of Air Company. Because they'd gone ahead and we were going to go through them. We were sort of going through their company. And Captain Ealing was coming back, and I remember he was wounded in his arm. He had his arm in a, I didn't think he had it in his sling. I think he was just holding it up there. Because at the same time, we lost Jammy Wright, who was a sergeant. We lost Jammy Wright just in front of us. He was wounded. He wasn't killed, he was wounded. Because I remember when I saw him, he was just in front of me, actually. And he went down like a poor last stay. He was a massive fella. He must have been about 15 or 16 stone, maybe more, big maybe 18 stone. Great big massive fella. And oddly enough, later on we found out he'd just been shot right through the ankle. Bullet had gone clean through his ankle. He went down like a really poor last stay. And that was the last I ever saw of him, oddly enough. I've made a lot of inquiries about him, but never found out about it. So he must have been one of the first ones that was wounded, Jammy Wright. I remember Captain Ealing coming back down with his arm sort of up there. And I tell you what we were finding in the corn, the German slit trenches must have been sniper trenches, actually, where the snipers were hiding out. Because they were like a hole about 6 foot deep, 6 or 7 foot deep maybe, 7 foot deep maybe. Just about the width of a van's shoulders, just wide enough for a bloke to get in. And about 2 foot down, maybe less than that, maybe a foot down, well, maybe 2 foot down, there was a broad, must have been well prepared like for, a long time. Because he had a broad piece of wood that acted as a seat. So in theory, if they were getting shelled, he could drop down it right into the bottom. And it was a million to one chance they were going to get hit by a direct hit. Then when they were, if the attack had been in the wind any other time, other than when the corn was high, they could just been on the seat and firing from that position. And yet, then when the corn was high, they stood on it, I suppose, and they could still fire over the top. marvellously constructed. And there was no spoil. It must have been there for donkeys, for a long time. Didn't seem to be any spoil round about. It was just little neat holes, in the corn,
Did you take any snipers?
I'll tell you what happened. Later on, of course, we made a point of getting the anti-tank guns up and knocking the tops off all the staples. I don't think round about Normandy there was one church had a staple on it, because that's where they were fighting, mostly that's where they would seem to be firing from. But as I say, that was maybe a bit later on when we started advancing towards Carr on the second advance on Labasi, because then we seemed to be, all we did was move up from the KSLI and us exchange positions. We were in Bayville, I don't know which was ahead or not. We were in Bayville, they were in Beauville, and then we changed over, and that was it. Maybe wake about, I think, something like that. We seemed to just change over with the KSLI, and they came back and we went forward.
You've mentioned the cornfields. Well, what was the terrain like that you're moving over?
Oh, it was very rough. Well, not saying it was rough. It was very enclosed. A lot of orchards and hidden roads, like little lanes with high banks. Always seemed to be lots of cover for snipers and people like that, you know. You didn't know what the hell you were going to meet around the next corner. But all little enclosed orchards, and in fact, there must be more for the ammunition buried in those orchards in France. I bet there's ammunition there still, because I must have buried dirty tons of ammunition and left it without sort of designating exactly where it was. I bet there's poor peasants there who didn't bury ammo even now, you know.
Why bury it? I mean, you were advancing it.
Well, it was just to make it safe, really, that, you know, if it was buried, if you got a direct hit on your ammo supplies, well, they all went up. Well, if you buried them to some extent, it lessened the impact of getting destroyed by enemy shelling, you know. So really, it was just a common sense venture that you buried. You know, if you were going to be there any length of time, we had sort of buried ammunition in our location, and we exchanged notes with the KSLI where theirs was, and you know, so we had ammunition in case of emergencies, I suppose, as well. You know,
were tanks up with you on this at this stage?
No, we didn't seem to get that. We didn't seem to see many tank regiments, actually. I think they were more towards the river, you know, maybe a bit more open country there, because it was very close country where we were. It wasn't very good, I would imagine. It wasn't very good tank country, because you know, the views were far too limited as far as tank warfare was concerned. Certainly wouldn't be very good.
And this is the country moving up towards Labisi.
Yeah, moving up towards Labisi, as I say, very close.
Were you able to call on air support?
Oh yeah. I understood that not that we did any calling on, as far as my company was concerned, but certainly there was a system whereby they could call on air support. Yeah.
The enemy that were opposing you, or did you have any idea who they were?
Well, we were just told that there was a large contingent of Hitler Youth, and the Jäger Regiment. I forget what the title was. The Jäger Regiment was in front of us, and I understand quite a lot of Hitler Youth who had been sent down as maybe reinforcements after the initial landing, you know, after the initial D-Day landing, because we met them actually on the second visit on Labisi. We were losing quite a few lads with mortar bombs and shell fire and sniper fire. At that time, we didn't lose a great deal, but we were losing, you know, one or two a day. I remember seeing two lads, in fact, and they had their mark on them, just injured by a blast, you know. That was pretty, you know, all on the roof, was. Nobody got much. I don't think those lads got much sleep at all. You know, it was all sort of. I didn't seem to get much sleep anyway, I think.
When you got to a night time situation, or first night actually, what was the rule then? What happened?
Well, normal rule that we stood two, of course.
You dug in, did you?
Dug in. Well, we were dug into positions. I remember we were in an old farmhouse actually. The company HQ was in an old farmhouse, and it had been evacuated that hurriedly. In fact, they didn't seem to take a thing with them. We were in this old farmhouse, like a little enclosed farmyard, and there's still stuff on the pretty tables and in the bedrooms, you know, they just seem to have taken off. And the thing I was most struck by in that part of France anyway was that everybody seemed to kill rabbits. There was rabbit butchers all over, every place where you went, there was little rabbit butchers. Because we were, you know, where we were, the Bayville and Beauville, like we were sort of in gardens and papers gardens and that sort of thing, you know. And a lot of them were still there. There was an old couple where they were in Bayville, in fact. I don't think they had any intention of moving. I don't think they knew what it was all about, maybe, to be honest.
Did you get any idea of how they felt?
Yeah, I got the impression that they weren't too keen on us being there, to be honest. That was the overriding impression I got.
Did they show it in any way?
There wasn't any overwhelming joy like, you know, in Bayville and Beauville. I thought it would be the same to me. I do not think they're safe like this. They seemed to me to be quite happy the way they were going on. You know, they maybe had lots of food, I suppose, and you know, out of the way place, away from the, you know, they did. I don't think they'd expected they did along with the fighting, of course. But certainly, I got the impression that there wasn't very many people coming along to welcome us on the road. One or two, I remember. One of the policemen, oddly enough, for one of the gendarmes, he was certainly glad to see us. But, you know, I got the impression that the general, well, he wasn't a great deal of general public like that we saw there. But of the odd people that we saw, I got the impression that I think they really wished that we'd hurry up and go away, like, you know. I think maybe further on, of course, once they got consolidated in maybe places like Cannes and, you know, places like that, I have no doubt that people were glad to see us, but certainly not where we were. Not that was my initial thought, I think.
You mentioned the fact that naval gunfire was there supporting you.
Yeah, yeah.
How effective was it?
Well, On day, very effective. But later on, I think when we'd expected having some support, it was non-existent because something had gone wrong with the communications, I think. But when we did this big advance on Le Bessy, when we'd gone on expecting some support by shell fire, it wasn't there, and I don't know what went wrong.
What are your own personal memories of the very first night after that quite hectic and stressful day?
I suppose I would have mixed emotions, I suppose. I was surprised it hadn't been worse than what it was. I think I was pleased that, I was in one place, like, but, you know, other than that, I think I was under the impression that it had been a lot easier than what I'd expected. I thought that, you know, we'd been stuck on the beach and all that sort of thing, and really hand to hand fighting and all that. But, you know, that's what everybody expected, I think. Certainly when we got sorted out, you know, after a couple of days, I think everybody was sort of rather pleased with the way it had gone, you know, because we hadn't had a great deal of many casualties, actually. You know, I think people had been expecting to be a hell of a lot of casualties, and we hadn't had them, you know, luckily. So I think everybody was rather pleased that the way they were.
When the battalion or company in your place, in your case, dug in at night, did you have certain duties to perform?
Oh yeah, we went around, of course, all the sentries. We posted sentries, of course, naturally. And either myself or one of the company commander or both, we made a point, of course, of going around all the sentry posts. And making sure that everything was okay, yeah. Well, that's just an accepted part of the duties, that's what we expected, yeah. So there's nothing untoward in what we were doing that we normally hadn't been trained to do, we had sort of hurried inspections of the lads and everything was okay, and made sure that the grub was coming up and...
You got food up that first night.
Yeah. It seemed to go very well, in fact. I was rather surprised, to be honest, that everything had seemed to go fairly well, The echelon seemed to be working very well.
But I mean, quite tiring, though. I mean, when do you get sleep?
I was absolutely buggered, to be honest. I didn't seem to stay for many days. I seemed to be on the go all the time. I was either going round to platoons or back to company HQ, saying about the ammo, whatever. Making sure the reports went off to the RSM, there's just so many reports and that sort of thing. I seem to be on the go all the time, to be honest. I didn't seem to have any sleep for bloody weeks. Not any real sleep, I suppose.
Was it one of your duties the first night to check on casualties?
Oh yeah, well that's a normal thing, of course, yeah. That you got your reports off your platoons, your platoon sergeant's reports. On your casualties, and they were naturally relayed up to the RSN, of course, as it happened in my case. It was my next stage of report via the company commander, of course. But you normally your two reports were your casualty returns and your ammunition returns. Those were the two reports that I had to make, of course, mainly. So you just report on how many casualties you have and how much ammo you want to, via your platoons, of course. It was all sort of an ongoing knock-on effect, in that sense.
Were you satisfied with the way that your commanding officer had performed that day?
I was killed, actually.
Mrs. Barrett, I think you said his name.
Oh, I called my company commander. Oh, yes, he was a great fella. As I say, when I first met him, of course, as I say, I related that story when I first met him. But he turned out a great fella, in fact, yeah.
But who was the one that was killed?
Oh, the CO was killed. Hoss Herden, I called him. He'd been killed. I don't know if he was killed that day, I think he was. A bloke called, second in command took over, called Kaiser, Cat, something like that, anyway. I think he'd been wounded at first, and then he'd gone back up there, as far as we gathered, and he'd been killed by machine gun fire. The CO, Hoss Herden, they call him. Very tall, distinguished looking fellow he was.